a room on the first floor, a bed and dresser and electric light for reading so I didn't strain my eyes. It rains across the country, I remember. That was a line from Trumbull Stickney, read in another room some other later year, but I remember feeling it in Portland, closing my eyes and burrowing in the sheets to listen to the water streaming down the walls outside, the brick streets rushing all that dark water downhill to the river, where it kept on going silently to sea and clear across to China. I was alone. I was alone, and it was more than I could bear to lie there listening to that driving rain.
The Country I Remember, readings and conversation featuring poet David Mason, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. David Mason's new book is The Country I Remember, a verse narrative of the Civil War.
This is a moment in The Country I Remember when Lieutenant Mitchell recalls his incarceration in the prison at a very low point in his experience there. They kept me 7 months in Libby prison, part of the time so sick I thought I'd die, the rest malnourished, hardly able to walk. The Rebs recaptured nearly half the men who crawled out through the tunnel. Some they kept below in cages where they fed on rats. The whole business was a bit discouraging. The more the war went on, the meaner it got, and we were glad to hear the Union guns start in on Richmond. One day a Reb guard came upstairs where we were sitting and said, "What are you boys doing?" He looked half crazed. I told him that as far as I could tell, we were prisoners of war. He was new, just a kid, looking at his line there. "You fellas ever get anything to eat?" I said we had a ration every day, and it was pretty good, but not enough. There was a bucket of beans and some cornbread brought up, and the boy looked at it and said, "Is that the kind of stuff you have in here?" He said he wouldn't touch it, for it was full of worms. I told him I don't see the worms. I ate my ration, but the rebel boy wouldn't eat. Next day, I guess he was hungry, and he said he couldn't see the worms either. The Confederates there ate the same rations we did, just like they were prisoners, too.
Poet and critic David Mason. His latest collection is a 12-part narrative poem, The Country I Remember, based on the Civil War experiences of his ancestors. Among them was Lieutenant John Mitchell, captured at the Battle of Chickamauga in 1863 and one of the engineers of the famous escape from Libby Prison. In The Country I Remember, David Mason also recalls the story of John Mitchell's daughter, Maggie, who grew up in the shadow of her adventurous father. The Country I Remember was recently cited for excellence by the Poetry Society of America and praised by Joyce Carol Oates for its powerful and intimate voices. With another excerpt from his new book of poems, here again is David Mason.
This is a point in The Country I Remember when Maggie Gresham remembers having left her family in Pomeroy, Washington, and moved to Oregon, and she remembers living alone in the city of Portland in the early 20th century and as a sort of crisis moment in her life. She says, "Maybe that is why we go on talking, always trying to show someone we're here, and look, I have a past just like you do, a stream of words that fills the empty night and sweetens troubled dreams, or so we hope, and tells us not to linger long on bridges, staring at all the water passing by. I thought my whole ambition was to make the past and present come together, dreamed into a vivid shape that memory could hold the way the land possesses rivers. They in turn possess the land and carry it in one clear stream of thought to drink from or water gardens with. I learned that I must first talk to myself, retelling stories, muttering a few remembered lines of verse to make the earth substantial and to bring the sunlight back. I thought of all the bones out on the prairie, of Mrs. Cress, who came aboard our train in a tight corset, so my sister Beatrice said she looked like an ant. I thought of land that flowed far out beneath us like a river, turning the dead face upward in the wake to talk to us of all their ruined lives in a babel of tongues. And then I knew I worked to keep these troubled dreams at bay and keep the talking dead from drowning me. It rains across the country, I remember.
David Mason, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
What are you doing with a Civil War story in this poetic narrative?
Well, I think as I began to compose the story, I wasn't necessarily thinking of it as a Civil War story. I wasn't coming to the story as a Civil War buff, although I've always been interested in history. But in point of fact, I think I don't really come to this subject as an historian. I come to it as a kind of mythologist. I think of the Greek word for a novel, the wonderful word they have, mythistorima. So it's a myth and history brought together in one narrative form.
Well, this is not a fair, not a bad description of what poets do as individuals and how they function in our culture. Let's talk about some of the specific points in The Country I Remember. Tell me about this wonderful phrase, acoustic shadows. This is a battle description, is it not?
That's right. It refers to the fact that in certain conditions, cannons can be firing in the distance, and yet the sound of the cannon fire can be inaudible because the people listening or seeing the flashes of cannon fire are somehow sheltered from the actual sound of it. So it looks like lightning flashes on the horizon.
It could also be the words of a poem on a page.
Exactly. So it had all sorts of personal ramifications for me. And as we were saying to each other earlier, I happened to be hard of hearing, so I suppose I was thinking of something along those lines too.
Right. What do you do with the Battle of Chickamauga? This is it Tennessee or Georgia? It's Tennessee, isn't it?
It's Tennessee, although the Union Army, as it pushed south, was spread out so far that they actually were moving into Georgia as well in their effort to outflank General Bragg. Part of what I've done is actually to use a couple of wonderful details that my ancestor left behind in his own account of the battle. Details like the fact that he gave the order to his men to suck a little bit of gunpowder out of their cartridges to give themselves a high as they went into battle.
And these were men who were almost dying of thirst to begin with.
They were absolutely thirsty and hungry. The Union Army had been pushing too long without a rest. And other wonderful details that I got from my ancestor. But there were a couple of moments when I try to describe the battle that I'm rather proud of. I mean, I've never fought in a battle. I know nothing about warfare whatsoever. My father was a sailor in World War II, but I know nothing about warfare. So I tried to imagine how terrifying it would be to be in those conditions. And one detail I'm rather proud of is the way Mitchell realizes after the first onslaught of fighting that his hand hurts because he's been gripping the hilt of his sword so tight.
This is the one that he has to give up when he's in prison.
Exactly.
You write about how wars are essentially boyish activities. Here we've got this wonderful contradiction and this paradox. War is hell. War is a nasty, brutish, awful thing, and yet it is something you consign it, as it were, to adolescence. How about it?
Yeah. In fact, that line, "All wars are boyish and are fought by boys," is a quote from one of the best poems by Herman Melville about the Union Army marching into Virginia. And John Mitchell, as an old man, remembers that line. He remembers his daughter reading that line to him. But he reminds us that he was, in fact, a bit older himself when he went into the war. I think in the Civil War there were lots and lots of boys going into battle, but there were also older men. And I don't know. I can't imagine anything like the experience they had. I mean, I've tried to imagine it, but I think it must be absolutely hellish. What I tried to capture was the sense of the The daliness of it, the effort to find food, the effort to find water.
The peach orchard, for example.
The peach orchard, where they go to steal peaches from a Confederate gentleman.
Uh-huh.
That sort of detail. The battle scenes themselves were something I was quite nervous about writing, simply because I hadn't had any experience like that.
Well, they're very vivid and they're very believable. I mean, you don't want to get too close to this kind of thing after a fashion. You give your imagination over to it. Would you say that you are functioning here? Is it poetry as poetry? That is to say, the aesthetics. You want us to listen to these words and sort of taste them and hear the way they rattle around in the mind. Or are we back into the vistas of history, the fine points, the accuracies of the Civil War?
Well, I would never pretend to be an historian, and I've never actually heard from an historian an opinion of this longer poem. I'm a poet. I'm interested in the individual voices of individual people, not only my own voice, but the voices of others. And I think what I'm really trying to do is to suggest that there's a lyricality in stories, and actually to use verse technique as a way of trying to make the story more memorable, more charged, more lyrical at certain moments, and hopefully more memorable.
How do you use place and geography, Dave? I mean, these are important concerns for
a
poet.
This is an extremely important matter for me. I happen to come from a family, no two generations of which have ever lived in the same place. So my sense of being an American is the sense of mobility, the sense of moving constantly. And so I knew when I was writing this longer poem that I was writing about a family on the move. They begin on the move at the start of the poem. They're in a train. Mitchell never stops moving himself. He walked across the country in 1852 to the Oregon Territory. He fought in an Indian war out there, went back to Illinois when Lincoln called for volunteers. His daughter was restless, always on the move, had wanderlust. So I'm using place, or rather I think it's better to say I'm using placelessness, and I'm using the desire to tell stories and to use language to create a sense of place. At the end of the poem, Mitchell says, "This is my home. This is my home because I say it is. I told you about my life so you would know how this place is my home." And so it's an effort of will to make yourself a home, to make yourself at home in this place.
Well, whether we're talking about geography and place or whether we're talking about the voices, again, that inspire your poetry, Dave, we hear two principal voices here. We have Maggie and we have her father.
Yeah.
How did you imagine them and talk to yourself and hear them in your own mind so that they would be authentic for us as we read the poem?
Well, interestingly enough, though I had this great story from family history about John Mitchell and all the war business that he'd been through, it was Maggie I first began writing about. What happened was that I took a book down from the shelf one day, an old family book, and opened it up, and a piece of paper fell out that was a typescript, a one-page typescript, of John Mitchell's daughter's account of moving across the country on a train in 1880. And there were one or two phrases in that account that I thought were very particular and striking. She didn't say we took cheese along with us. She said we packed a cheese, a stack of pies, boiled ham, and jars of fruit
preserves. This is what they eat on the train.
Yeah, exactly. So there were just a couple of phrases or details, and suddenly I became interested in this voice. So I began writing in her voice, and then, because I'd never met John Mitchell's daughter and I'd never heard anything about her, Maggie, for me, became a completely fictional character, and she became somebody whose sense of herself is very tenuous, her sense of her own identity is very tenuous, because she's been so devoted to her family and to her father over the years.
No, she doesn't start to really live until she's in her 30s,
exactly,
isn't that right?
Exactly. She feels as if she doesn't have any real life of her own.
Right.
So I began to think of her as a kind of interior voice, a very imaginative, sensitive, private voice. And then once I began to invent this character of John Mitchell, loosely based on my ancestor, I began to think of him as a much more robust character. I come from a family of very adventurous people, mountaineers and that sort of thing. And at the end, you could perhaps say that Maggie Gresham's life has been rather sad. She's lost her husband. She's childless. But she says at the end of her life, "I was moved by everything that moved." And when I hit that line, I'll tell you, I felt moved myself. Mm-hmm. I want the reader to feel moved by the thisness of life, by the here and now, by the weight of our own existence. I want a greater awareness of our own existence is what I want the reader to have.
Let's talk about how poets work and what they do in this mass culture. I guess the tough 50-cent question is, what good are poets? I mean, we live in a world of, my goodness, anything but poetry. How about this?
Well, it seems to me that if poetry is any good at all, it becomes what Auden and other poets have called memorable speech. And it seems to me very, very important that we have a language brought to a pitch of clarity and accuracy on occasion in our lives. Obviously, all of us can't live at that pitch of poetic intensity for most of our lives. But we need moments when poetry brings us to a kind of, oh, not purified language, but clarified language, a more accurate language, a more memorable language. I love very much a comment Robert Frost made that the whole of ambition was to lodge a few poems where they will be difficult to get rid of. And it seems to me that that's what we're after. We're after right. memorable speech.
How does it work with you poets when, again, to speak candidly here, you call it a poem, but why should everybody else call it a poem? I mean,
sure.
You know, we got people who stand up at poetry slams.
Yeah.
They read something off the back of an envelope and everybody claps. And
yeah.
Now, I take it that that doesn't represent for you the real work of the poet. Or are we going to play elitist here? How does this work?
No, I'm not a purist or an elitist at all. In fact, I think some lovely moments that I would call poetic happen in popular music and happen at poetry slams or happen in any number of places. I think some poetry exists in prose. I think it can be found in any number of places. I just happen to be a kind of poet who believes in trying to marshal all the resources of language in some intensified form to make the poem. And other kinds of poets don't work in that particular way. Some poets write for the page. I write for the ear, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any absolutist sense of what a poet ought to be doing.
Give us a sense, Dave, of this term, the new formalism. Now, are we going to resort to iambs and trochees and words that rhyme and words that don't? What is that all about?
The technical language is extremely helpful for readers of poetry in certain ways. But ultimately what matters is memorable speech, I think. The new formalism is a term that was coined by some critics, I believe in the 1980s, to describe a phenomenon in American poetry in which large numbers of younger poets began to write in rhyme and meter again at a time when many people thought that rhyme and meter were dead. And the term was first used in a derogatory fashion to dismiss these younger poets and to suggest that obviously they were doing something irrelevant if they were so silly as to think rhyme and meter could possibly have any use to contemporary poetry. But as the movements become stronger and stronger, the appellation has stuck, and I've just edited this anthology called Rebel Angels, 25 Poets of the New Formalism. I didn't really want to use the term New Formalism in the subtitle. I've edited it with Mark Jarman. But we were stuck with it. We couldn't get away from it. After a while, the appellation's just been with us that long.
Give us a sense of how you connect with this large term, the tradition. In the country, I remember you mentioned, there's some Whitman there, there's Longfellow, there's this obscure poet,
Trumbull Stickney.
Trumbull Stickney. Yeah. How does all of that work for you?
Well, in point of fact, the people I'm writing about in the country I remember are not people with higher education of any sort.
These poets that I mentioned are,
sure.
I mean, they speak to the common person.
Exactly. And I'm loosely affiliated with a group of poets called the New Formalists who really believe in speaking to as broad a readership as possible without in any way detracting from the power of the art.
We're back to Wordsworth, are we not?
I think it's very Wordsworthian, program.
We can call him a sexist, a man speaking to men,
sure,
but
sure.
You're on that.
I think very much we're very much in line with Wordsworth's program, and there are other sorts of things going on. I don't think many new formalists are as romantic in their sensibilities as Wordsworth.
Well, then poetry, I take it, is taking a bum rap when people say it belongs to this tiny little select arcane few who have refuge in the universities and are not really part of our mass culture.
Yeah, it really is taking a bum rap. And the terrible truth of the matter is that though I'm a professor, I think my profession has done some damage to the art of poetry by emphasizing poetry that is difficult and arcane and that must be studied in a classroom. When I teach poetry to 18-year-olds, I have them memorize whatever they want, from Mother Goose to Robert Frost, and the act of memorization and the act of reciting the poem convinces them that they can, in fact, partake of the world of poetry.
Well, now that sounds so appealing. I mean, it is wonderful to think about how poetry can function in our schools, and yet it has such an enormous amount of competition in this mass culture.
Yeah, it does.
The internet, television, movies. Is it a lost battle, or is it something that a very small battlefield after all?
Well, I believe so strongly about the importance of poetry that I would say if it's a lost battle, we're in big trouble, because I think poetry is the art that keeps the language real. And without a language that's real, our political life and our cultural life will disintegrate. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. But I don't really believe it's a lost battle, even though everything in our culture works toward the creation of mass culture. The poet is a member of a sort of cottage industry, is still working away at trying to make something genuine, something real. It's something handmade, as it were. And there will always be room for that sort of craft in our culture.
What, by way of concluding here, David Mason, what advice have you got to, not necessarily young people, just anybody listening to this conversation who says, gosh, I want to write a poem, but I'm really a little ashamed of this impulse. How about that?
Well, I know very well how that feels, and I know what it's like to be ridiculed for wanting to be a poet or wanting to be a poet of a particular kind. No one can ever tell you how to write what you are going to write. Ultimately, you must decide for yourself what you're going to do, what sort of poet you're going to do, what sort of story you have to tell. You can learn a lot from other people, but ultimately nobody else can tell you how to be the writer you're going to be. And I think you have to give yourself permission, as it were, to use a kind of popular phrase these days, to fail. You have to let yourself jump in, take a stab at it, try to do this job, and fail miserably for many years before you manage to bring something off. Or maybe you'll get lucky and have a success early on. I think it's pretty important to let yourself fail and to not be too worried about that.
David Mason, I want to thank you for taking this time on Soundings. You are a professor at Morehead State University up in Minnesota. Your books include The Country I Remember, The Buried Houses, Land Without Grief, and this new collection, which is called, hold that one up there for me.
Rebel Angels.
Rebel Angels. This is 25 Poets of the New Formalism.
Which I co-edited with Mark Jarman of Vanderbilt University.
Well, Dave, I really appreciate this time on Soundings, and I certainly wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much. It's been great.
David Mason's new collection of poetry is The Country I Remember, available from Storyline Press. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. Before that, with more of his poetry, here again is David Mason.
This is a poem that tells a personal and absolutely true story about something that happened to me and my father and my younger brother a year after my older brother's death. It's called Emotion We Cannot See. We found the path somewhat as it had been, heather and rock of an alpine meadow, ringed by peaks like giants in a myth we never learned. All our lives we had played among them, and perhaps our grief was payment of an unknown debt. Perhaps the strange mist caused us to question the path, but our boots made a familiar sound on the dirt runnel. The gray rocks and stunted firs were congregated as before. We couldn't say why we had come. Two living brothers and our father, whose hands were like ours and like our brother's hands, bones and hair so much like ours, flesh of our silent flesh. I saw the place where we had cupped the ashes, letting them blow and drift over the heather. A year of snow and snowmelt later, what could be left of him, so utterly possessed by mountains? Yet after the year of weather, tiny pieces of my brother's bones still lay in clefts of rock. We found them under our hands, cupping them once again in wonder at what the giants left us. Since then, I have not gone back to hold my brother's bones. The prayers of blizzard and snowmelt have him now, and time flows down the mountain like the ice, a motion we cannot see, though it bears our blood almost forever.
It's Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was poet and critic David Mason. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. For a cassette tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 849. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week on Soundings, Eric Myers of Duke University and Rebecca Martin Nagy of the North Carolina Museum of Art will be here to talk about Sepphoris in Galilee, an international archaeological project representing cross currents of culture. Until next week's show, this is Wayne Pond. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.